I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, searching this Pope Francis phenomenon. The man from Argentina and his many messages from Rome, his body language, feet washings, mob scenes in Vatican Square. He even uses words now and then, as the 13th century Saint Francis urged back in the day. Pope Francis wants a church that's bruised, hurting, and dirty. His words, in the streets with real people, not confined or clinging to its own security. He had the audacity, as no pope did before him, to choose the beloved name Francis for the saint of birds and nature, the saint marked hand and foot with the wounds of Jesus. As the votes were being cast to elect him last spring, the name entered my heart, he said, Francis of Assisi. For me, he is the man of poverty, the man of peace, the man who loves and protects others. We're going to search his past, his plans for a faith and an institution that seem to be limping. We want to search ourselves, too. What is the human hunger Pope Francis has confirmed? And not just Catholic or churchy, all across the world. What is the wavelength on which so many non-religious people get him? Why was he Time Magazine's hands-down runaway pick for Man of the Year 2013? And what does the blogger Andrew Sullivan mean when he says, you don't have to be a believer to recognize a moment of grace, delivering not hope, but proof that hope is not groundless? Here first is what some of you said on our open source hotline when we asked for short takes on how this pope got to you.
Here's what I love about Pope Francis. He uses his position of power in ways that don't cling to pageantry or position or prestige, but kind of disinvests himself of those things.
I think he understands that love is really the only reason for doing anything.
His humility. He may be the pope, but he is just another man, just like us.
After being a Catholic for all of my life, all these 50 years, I have to say that I find him to be the most humane and the most touchable of all the popes.
I think this pope channels the spirit in which Jesus taught. This is where it touches me, and I'm certainly not a Roman Catholic.
I think the pope is irresistible because he's real, he's kind, and he brings me an enormous sense of hope for all of the people who have felt captured by the Catholic Church, who are now free.
It just seems to me if Bill Clinton was the first black president, Pope Francis has to be the first gay pope.
James Carroll, get us started. Ex-priest, novelist, National Book Award memoirist, practicing Catholic. You wrote the New Yorker profile that came out at Christmas time, Jim, that said, in a nutshell, Pope Francis is not a liberal, as many Americans and maybe you want him to be, but you say he is a radical. Meaning what?
Well, he goes right... Let me interrupt myself, Chris, and say what a thrill it is to be in the show with you.
And with you, Jim. Thank you.
He goes right to the issue of power, both inside the church and outside. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean by radical. Power to the people. We're old enough, you and I are old enough, to remember the weight that phrase once had in the streets of the world, really. And there's a way in which that's the slogan this pope has lifted up in all but that phrase. His deep, deep commitment to lift up the plight of the vast majority of human beings on this planet, the power imbalance of the world economy. Within the Catholic Church, some of us are anxious for him to adjust the abuses, for example, of the way women are discriminated against, the horrible exploitation by power of children in the tradition of the church. My own view is that the moral collapse of the authority of the church is the precondition of this pope's arrival. Mm. And he understands, if only viscerally, that the issue both inside the church and outside is power. Reorganize, organize democracy, not monarchy, not, as one of your guests just called in, not the regalia of someone presiding from above, but someone who's one of us. This is a radical democratic vision, and it's bound to affect, in the short term, the church itself. And I think I'm hopeful that it will have a long-term effect on the polity of the world.
Jim, that's a huge agenda. Let's get at it. But first, you stood with 100,000 of the Pope's best friends one day recently in Vatican Square. What did you see there? What did you learn on those faces?
Well, his face first. You know, the man is normal. He's a human being who has that gift of being simply who he is, at home in himself, at home in his body. So, you know, there's a way in which we all understand the authenticity of someone's presence. Mm. And I think that's what is so compelling. And it isn't the charism of a rock star. This is something else. This is a person who reflects back at you who you are. He's immediately engaging you. I would love to have had a personal encounter with him, but it was personal enough for me to actually meet his gaze and share eye contact with him, and I felt looked at. I felt seen, actually, is a better way to put it. And I think that's the effect that I saw, you know, many, many, many people have in his presence. A vast population of people, and yet it felt very intimate.
I want to credit Andrew Sullivan, whom I don't always, but he said that point well, that there is something just in the presence. Francis, like Jesus, says Andrew, has had such an impact in such a short period of time simply because of the way he seems to be.
I'd strike a cautionary note here. We shouldn't be too quick to compare him to Jesus. We shouldn't be too quick to canonize him. We shouldn't be too quick to elevate him above other people. The point this man is making is he's said no to that. He said no to that official office, that kind of papacy above. And he's said no to sainthood. Our attachment to the man is essentially about his being one of us. And it's a mistake. Our impulses are all about lifting someone up, making them a hero. And of course, you know that that's always part one of a story that leads to the part two where we have to bring them down. This Pope is about something else, I would say.
Jim, I want you to take apart the core question to me. Implied in all his words about the poor, suggesting, as Harvey Cox does in an article in The Nation magazine, that he is going to bring liberation theology back, the preferential option for the poor, not just sympathy or emulation, but a tilt in the church, which the church experimented with in the 70s and in effect turned away from. One of the first things this pope did, I mean, I think a day or so after he became pope, he summoned Father Gutierrez of Peru for breakfast in Rome with him. People wonder if he's reliving his own life in Argentina in the 70s and 80s. Is he repenting for mistakes during the military dirty war in Argentina in that period? Is he serious about a, shall we say, a policy change, a different church under the liberation rubric?
It's a hugely important issue, and a quick trip down memory lane wouldn't hurt here. Let's remember what liberation theology was. Dom Helder Camara, the bishop, the Brazilian bishop, captured it when he said, when I care for the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why there are so many poor, they call me a communist.
Yeah.
The most important thing to remember about liberation theology in Bergoglio's time, when Pope Francis was the provincial superior of the Jesuits, is that liberation theology was an explosive point of contention during the Cold War. And one of the tragedies of the Cold War is the way in which concern for the poor in the West, and especially from the United States, was taken as a signal of some kind of conspiratorial alliance with the communist movement, as if concern for the poor made one suspect. And that was a kind of defining note of the Cold War. And that's the context within which the dirty war in Argentina unfolded in the 70s. And it's the context in which liberation theology became suspect. Pope John Paul II was suspicious of liberation theology, coming from his Polish background as a man radically committed to oppose communism. And he sensed in liberation theology, with its critique, its class critique of a small elite oligarchy controlling the vast resources of a huge population, he sensed in that a kind of Marxism, and it was a bum rap for liberation theology. Liberation theology was rooted not in Karl Marx, but in Jesus Christ, in the gospel. And Pope Francis came to that through the hard and searing experience of failing in his first experience of this question, failing to take the voices of liberation theology seriously enough. He criticizes himself for that now.
But there's the question.
But this goes back to the first point, which is about power. And post-Cold War, concern for the poor has to be not just in charity terms, but in terms of justice, a matter of rearranging the structures of power.
But let me ask Jim, does his breakfast with Father Gutierrez, Father Gutierrez, who is in a continual dialogue with Paul Farmer in his medical outreach with preferential option for the poor, but does the breakfast with Father Gutierrez suggest that the new pope wants to lead the church in a kind of do-over of the last 35 years?
Yes, and let's, to give Pope Francis full credit, the do-over for him began 20 years ago when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. He's been a figure of liberation theology in his time as the leader of the church in Argentina. His embrace of Gustavo Gutierrez is symbolically very important. Gutierrez is the man who coined the phrase liberation theology. Gutierrez is the living hero of it in a way. And so that was an immediate and powerful act of reconciliation with a mistaken denigration of this tradition. Power to the people means power to the people. And one not only says that out of liberation theology, one says it out of the gospel. That's the point.
Hold it there, Jim. We'll continue this. We're talking about Pope Francis, the Bishop of Rome, the Vicar of Christ in his church, and about the wider world's fascination with him. Mary Gordon is a novelist in the front rank since her final payments in the 1970s. She's been a steady light since then among those American writers labeled Catholic. Reading Jesus in 2009 was her last book, a long essay on the modern truth of the Gospels. On the phone the other day, I asked Mary Gordon to help us understand this Francis time.
I don't understand it yet. When I first read the article that he wrote in the Jesuit magazine, I literally burst into tears. And what that signaled to me was how sad I had been for so long, that is, since 1978, since the reign of John Paul II. And it was as if what I had hoped for the church, which I had given up hope on, suddenly seemed possible again. But hope is a frightening thing, particularly when, you know, you're not 18 and a lot of things that you had hoped for, a lot of people that you had believed in, turned out to have been disappointing. That's one of the things that's hard to deal with as you age. The article that was in the Jesuit magazine in which he said, you know, stop obsessing about abortion and homosexuality, and that I'm a healer, this is a war zone. Particularly what made me happy was that he loved Anna Magnani.
Interesting.
And his favorite movie was
La
Strada.
Yes, fascinating.
I thought, okay, you know, this is a good guy. And I felt like saying to him, Pope, do you understand, though, that Anna Magnani was on the condemned list? We weren't allowed to watch her. You know, what I had been saying, could we get off the dime of sexual obsession? And he was saying it. And it just seems so wonderful, and it opened up so many things that it made me feel a little hysterically giddy, and then I got scared. And so I want him to be what I hope he is so much that it almost scares me. What has changed with Francis is the tone. And as a writer, obviously, tone is not nothing. Tone is tremendously important. So that rigid, punitive tone that John Paul II and Benedict had, Francis doesn't have it. If only that has changed, that's wonderful.
What do you make of us in this whole story? Help us understand what seems to me a very broad public appetite for a man of spirit. There's adulation in it, maybe excessive, but there's belief. There's hype, yes, there's hunger. What's going on here among us?
I think it's got to be a good thing. It seems to me there are two real meta-narratives in the world. And it's the narrative, one is the narrative of unbridled capitalism, and the other is the narrative of murderous fundamentalism. And people are spiritually exhausted by that. One of the great things that he's saying is, who am I to judge? Just that openness and generosity, the fact that there's still a hunger for that, that in itself is enormously hopeful. And I would hate to see that dashed and disappointed and killed.
What else are we hungering for? And I say we, the species.
One of the things that we're most hungering for is hope, because it's a pretty scary world. And one of the things that I like about the Pope is people think that they can only have hope if they have certainty. And he is offering hope that's a little bit open-ended and a little bit unsure. And so it's a hope for grown-ups. And I think hope for grown-ups is what we're hungering for. I've kind of hung in when it was really hard for me to hang in, because I think that there are things that the church does that the world would not be better off without. I think that it has a combination of the ethical, the aesthetic, and the mystical at its best that is really invaluable, and that it had been perverted by its sexual phobias. He's certainly moving us in the right direction.
Thank you, Mary Gordon. I like that line about hope for grown-ups. There's a lot more of that conversation with Mary Gordon on our website, radioopensource.org. Jeff Charlotte, with me in the studio, plays a role like none other I know. He's an independent searcher and reporter on movements, trends, and varieties of religious life in America today. It started for me, Jeff, with your website that became a book, Killing the Buddha, the best spiritual writing, somebody said, since Jack Kerouac hit the road. I think he was sort of William James in a camper. But are we getting the Francis phenomenon right yet?
I don't think we are, and I don't think the American press is particularly interested in getting the Francis phenomenon right. I think, you see, there's exceptions to that, like Jim's really wonderful piece in The New Yorker. But there's one line in Jim's terrific, terrific essay. And if you want to understand Francis, go there. Don't read the Time magazine cover story or anything like this. Go there. But there's that one line, Jim, in which you speak of Francis declaring a unilateral truce in the culture war. And you prefaced your remarks here by saying, look, he's a radical. He's not a liberal. And yet so much of the press is using that idea of a truce in the culture war as a way of making Francis into a centrist who stands in for civility, of who is sort of set apart from the church of which he's a part of. So they're sort of, when they talk about that radical economic critique, what we hear again, quoted again and again, is Francis's comment, why do we not care less about the death of a homeless person than a 2-point drop in the stock market? We don't hear the really sharp pointed critiques of the free markets. We hear folk tales, urban legends of Francis sneaking out at night to spend time with the poor. And there's nothing the Vatican can do, seemingly, to quell those stories, so much so that in Time, in their cover story, they said, well, the Vatican denies that this is true, but they probably have to say that. So there's a sort of desire for this kind of good king figure. So here he is coming along, and I hope you're right, Jim, with this radical democratic message. But we're not getting Francis right, because the story that our American media is mostly telling is one of a good king who comes along very much like Obama before him in 2008, and really like Reagan so many years before that, one who transcends our bitter moment.
In short, we see him in our own terms. We secularize him somewhat. We do try to place him somewhere between the death of Nelson Mandela and the disappointment in Barack Obama, I don't know.
To frame it in
our terms of spirituality, which run toward the Hallmark greeting card variety.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're not so much secularizing him as sentimentalizing him. and making him spiritual. This is the phrase. In fact, the New York Times had a piece the other day in which we had a number of leading Democrats talking about how spiritual he was, and with a certain amount of glee, as if Francis has come along to occupy an electoral position on the American political spectrum, somewhere to slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, slightly to the left of Al Franken. We know right where to place him. We know right where to do this. And he is spiritual. And what's left unsaid is that is the phrase, the way that phrase usually continues, spiritual but not religious. There's a way as if it's not so much secularizing Francis as breaking him off from the Catholic Church. So you see some of these conservative writers saying, yes, the Pope is still Catholic, reminding that it's not just that the radical message that most of the American press is leaving out. They are also mostly leaving out the ongoing conservative message. The fact that who am I to judge has left a lot of LGBT advocates scratching their heads. Why did The Advocate, the oldest gay magazine in America, make him the person of the year for what is a very, very tepid statement? No one really wants to deal with that strange divide, mm-hmm. the way he doesn't fit into our politics. We need him to be a political figure rather than the religious figure that he is.
Well, so, Jim Carroll. Amplify maybe what Jeff's saying, but maybe there's a disagreement here, Jeff. Let me ask you if there is. The phrase culture war, as I use it, had explicit reference to the debate in the United States of America. People starving to death in the developing world are not concerned about a culture war. They're concerned about their next meal. And it's interesting that that seems to be the Pope's preoccupation. But it's crucially important for the United States of America that the Pope has undercut the ground on which Catholic bishops in this country have been standing in their alliance with the Republican Party. So when the Pope says, we've been giving much too much attention to issues like contraception, gay marriage, abortion, he is undercutting the stance of Catholic bishops who are telling Catholic politicians they can't receive communion if they're wrong on those issues. The Pope has totally undercut that very conservative, I would say reactionary impulse that has taken the Catholic Church in the United States hostage in the last generation. The exceptions to that, for example, the great American nuns, have been assaulted by the Vatican over these culture war issues. So I would insist the Pope has, in fact, in this American-centric preoccupation for a moment, has in fact declared, yes, a unilateral truce in this culture war. And he's actually put our attention on much more drastic issues like the plight of immigrants and migrant peoples. And he can't draw attention to the plight of African migrants coming into Europe without amplifying something new in the immigration debate in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
And it's going to be much harder for Catholic politicians to vote no on immigration reform today than it was 3 months ago.
Right.
This is a new, there's a new power of the clear preferential option for the poor back again. And that is...
Right. And it's neither sentimental nor spiritual.
It's
real. It's located in history in this moment, and it implies action. Forgive me, Jim. Let me introduce Liz Walker, who needs none. Liz Walker was the revered host of Eyewitness News on Channel 4 in Boston. She is now the ordained and Reverend Liz Walker, soon-to-be pastor of the Roxbury Presbyterian Church. Liz Walker, welcome. How are you feeling this Pope Francis moment?
Well, first of all, I too am just excited to be here with this incredible panel that you've pulled together this evening. But I must say, in listening to this, Jim, you said we shouldn't really go too far in comparing the Pope to Jesus, but that's exactly what we're doing. And for me, as a fledgling minister, it's not so much Jesus as spirit, Jesus as, and I'm sure that's what it should be, but it's the humanity. It's this notion of what it really means to be human at its best. And that's what this man is kind of channeling in just little ways. And it is touching all of us. And I'm reading Abraham Joshua Heschel, and he says one of the maladies of our time, and he said this, 40 years ago in Moral Grandeur and Spiritual Audacity, one of the maladies of our time is shattered confidence in human nature. And everybody in the world has that, right? In China, in Africa, in Roxbury. We don't know how to verbalize it, but we're all kind of hopeless, I guess is the word, but we don't even know what it means to have hope. And so here's a man who, in these ways of touching and his body language and the little things that he says, and we can parse those words politically or we can just feel better. Yeah. He makes us feel better. And it doesn't matter what your politics are. There's something very authentic, as you've already said, about what he's doing. So I look at it as kind of a seeing what Jesus would have been, the word made flesh. What does it mean to channel that? It's not spiritual, it's not political, but there's something good about it. It's grace. Mm-hmm. It's all of that. So for me, he makes us feel better. It makes us feel bigger.
Can I jump in on the word hope, which we're overusing? Yeah, I want to take it apart a little bit the way we were starting to about the word spiritual. For me, it's tricky. Hope is a biblical virtue, but it's not easy. It comes from a hard place. I love especially St. Paul to the Romans. He says, and I remember Jesse Jackson quoting this, just sort of standing on a street corner. He said, quoting Paul, "We glory also in tribulations, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, patience worketh experience, and experience worketh hope." Hope comes out of a dark place. It is not hope that the Red Sox are going to win the series again next year. It's not hope that the sun will come up, you know, bright and early. It's an assurance underneath our faith that the Lord is real, that it is my Father's world. And furthermore, and it's not just in the Christian or biblical tradition, that we are soul and spirit. We are invisible. We are inward. We are insubstantial. And that the Pope, I think the meaning of the Pope's peace and harmony, even his lovable ism, is that he suggests a kind of bedrock of hope. And it's not a sort of sentiment.
I agree. But he makes us, to me, we just don't have these people that we see anymore, that we're always looking for the strings behind it, or the wink, wink, nod, nod, or you're going to get caught, or you're lying, or you're just, you know, and here's this authenticity that we it's like seeing a rose, and I know it's a rose, and even if we can't verbalize it, we know he represents something better about ourselves.
Well, Liz, you said something about the humanness that he's embodying and reminding of us at our most human, and that brings me back to his biography. And the moment that I find most interesting, the moment that Jim, you suggest that part of what he was doing was repenting for things that happened during the Dirty War. I don't want to use the word mistakes because I don't think we're clear what happened. And I think they may have been deeper than mistakes. But there's no question that this idea that this man is repenting. And here is this man who is talking about a bruised and a dirty church. And that, I would like to hear more of that in the narrative that we receive here. I can only speak to, I haven't stood among the 100,000 closest friends, so I can only speak to the story that we receive here. I want to hear more about that story. And the fact that he has let that be out there is interesting. I'd like to see our colleagues in the media pick it up and say, not in an investigative, let's gotcha kind of way, but say, let's talk about the fact that real wrongs have been made, and the way that he has broadened that out to the whole church and said, look, we've done wrong things. And that's what's going to allow us to hear him as speaking, not as a distraction. Let's talk about this wonderful Pope and his clunky shoes and the fact he drives a neat little car rather than talking about sex abuse. Let's have Time Magazine put him as the man of the year. Let's talk about how he uses social media and Twitter and isn't technology fun instead of talking about Edward Snowden. I want to hear him bring that tribulation out, and that's where that hope is going to come from. And to do that, there needs to be some participation in the media here.
Well, there is no hope. There is no hope if we know at some point that this person we're talking about is not real. And his insistence, when he's asked, "Who are you?" as the Father Spadaro asked him in the notable Jesuit interview, "Who are you?" His immediate response was, "I am a sinner." Mm-hmm. And then he said, "And that is not a figure of speech." And he has said again and again and again about himself, "Errors, errors, errors. I was authoritarian. I made terrible mistakes." He can call them mistakes. He's also called them sins. This is the ground of his, "Who am I to judge?" He's not speaking rhetorically. He's speaking as a man who has reckoned with the limits of his own condition. And let me just say, the dirty war is one issue, and the grotesque failure of the church hierarchy on priest sex abuse is another. And on that, the measure of this pope has yet to be established. As of a couple of weeks ago, I know it's true, he had not yet met with victims of the priest abusers. He had not yet begun to move to hold bishops accountable for their protection of those priests. There's a long way to go in this question.
I sought out the writer Peter Manso earlier today at his home in Baltimore. He wrote a brilliant op-ed in the Times months ago about married priests, a no-no in the Catholic Church, of course, but his father was one. Is one, in fact. He's still married to Peter's mother, and he's still a priest by his own lights. Peter is a devoted son, not an active Catholic. This goes into my file on the infinite varieties of religious experience, the individuality, the courage, the discrimination that all sorts of people bring to their religious lives. I asked Peter Manso how this new Pope Francis registers on his heart, in his history.
When I was growing up, the Pope loomed large in my family's life. Obviously, this would have been Pope John Paul II. We didn't have a picture of him hanging in the kitchen as previous generations of Catholics might. But one of my earliest memories is actually going to see him drive by in Boston when he made his first visit to the United States in 1979. I would have been about 5 years old. My mother bundled us up so we wouldn't get what she called Pope colds. But just the feeling of euphoria, of people five deep in the streets of Boston ready to watch Pope John Paul's car rolled by. And that feeling of being part of something so vast and jubilant, that was what my parents wanted their children, myself and my brother and my sister, to understand about what being members of the Roman Catholic Church meant. And yet, the Pope was for me also a symbol of something else, something less welcoming. From an early age, I knew that my parents gave their lives to the church for a decade each, until they met at a time of great turbulence in the church. In the wake of the Second Vatican Council, my mother, like many women who had become teaching sisters, who had become nuns, decided to leave. That life was not for her. And my father, inspired by the Second Vatican Council, really thought the church was changing and that soon priests would be allowed to marry, as priests of the Episcopal Church were. And so he decided to take the plunge and become the test case for that. He wanted to know if a number of priests began to marry, would that force the Vatican's hand and start to change the rules? So my parents decided to marry in 1969. It was a big stir in Boston at the time. There was a headline in a number of papers that said, "Lowell priest marries Boston nun." Great scandal. Though it was the practice at the time, it was the expectation that if a priest left the priesthood to marry, he would relocate 500 miles at least from where anyone knew he was a priest in order to avoid giving scandal to the faithful, as they called it at the time. My parents decided to stay in and around Boston and to raise their family there because they wanted to show that they were not ashamed that they had given their lives to the church, and they were also not ashamed that they were trying to change the church through their actions. So I grew up both very much within the church and also feeling that I was an outsider within it.
It's fascinating to me. You're the second person in 2 weeks who's told exactly this story. His father not only is a priest who got married, but he says he's still a priest. He consecrates Mass at home every day. What's intriguing to me is just the flexibility that some people find in a rule-bound church to make their own rules.
Yes. You know, I think there are more of us than you would imagine, the sons and daughters of priests and nuns. In fact, I have a friend who is a priest, and he told me once that he thought people like me represented the end of a mystery story. Because back in the day when they were watching their priest and nun friends leaving to get married, the question was, well, what will happen? What will happen to their families? What will happen to their children? And now, as those children are becoming adults and beginning to have their own opinions about the church, I think we're finding out.
That was Peter Manso, the writer, at home in Baltimore. We're talking about Pope Francis with Liz Walker, Jeff Charlotte, and Jim Carroll. Jim, you were just beginning to lay out what sounds like an urgent justice agenda, reparations agenda. How much of this is to be sort of counted off in specific actions?
Well, you know, I think it's important to step back and take a little credit away from the Pope and give some credit to this moment, to a crucially large historical force, which is a reckoning with an imminent catastrophe. And the analogy I would draw is to Gorbachev. This man is a Catholic Gorbachev. At a moment,
so glad you said that.
Well,
at a moment
when the thing that threatened catastrophe was paired nuclear arsenals of more than 100,000 weapons, Gorbachev opened a brand new day for the human species and led the way out of that catastrophe. Nuclear weapons are still a deadly threatening issue in our lives, but they aren't the issue that threatens the catastrophic breakdown of the human family, which is massive inequality. Inequality now is defining the way in which the future of the human species is most threatened. Inequality with billions of people, the vast majority of human beings, desperately trying to scratch out a way to survive, and a very small minority of people with the privilege of much more than we need to live. And the Pope has drawn attention to this huge problem of inequality with great power. His first trip outside of Rome was to Lampedusa, an island in the Mediterranean where desperate migrants from Africa are dying to get a new life for their families, dying by the thousands. And the Pope went there and said mass there and addressed a sports field full of mostly Muslim migrants and basically forced Europe to pay attention to what was happening on its southern border. That's a small instance of a very large call that this man has sounded for us. And we simply, as a people, have to begin to take this seriously. It's the most pressing issue facing the human family.
I was struck by maybe a shallower sense of the Gorbachev moment. Gorbachev assigned, in a way, and a good, smart man to save the Soviet Empire from decay and dissolution. He made a noble effort and didn't pull it off. But he didn't also start as radically or as appealingly as the Pope has.
Right. So the point about Gorbachev is he has two meanings. One, inside the Soviet Empire, which he found a way to dismantle nonviolently. And two, for the world itself, the larger world. The events of the late 80s, which culminated, of course, in the Great Mandela, but also culminated in the Irish peace process, the peaceful revolution in the Philippines, the dismantling of the Soviet Empire in Europe, the end of the Contra Wars in the Middle East, the outbreak of peace that seized the human imagination in 1990, 1991, 1992, 1993, that was all in the train of what Gorbachev had set in motion by refusing to take no for an answer from Ronald Reagan. And I'm arguing is that scale of historic impact is what we sense as possible in a very inchoate and inarticulate way at this point in Pope Francis. And the issue is world poverty.
Can I just ask a question?
Please, Liz Walker,
here.
You must.
And all of this, and he's only been there for a year? Less than a year,
March.
So what about the possibility, and I ask this of all three of you, of change? I mean, we don't know that he's going to you know, he comes out this strong in the beginning, but this is a powerful church and anything can happen. Maybe he won't. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes, of course.
Will he be as effective?
Well, he's already set in motion inside the church a democratic process that's unprecedented by basically taking an already established institution, the Synod of Bishops, and demanding that it take on a new mission, a more democratic mission. Mm-hmm. He has required the parishes, the Catholic parishes of the world, to actually survey the opinions of Catholic lay people, you know, more than a billion Catholics, to find out what they think about these basic issues that have been breaking the authority of the church for two generations: birth control, divorce, abortion, gay marriage, the rights of homosexuals, the place of women. This pope has set in motion a new democratic impulse inside the Catholic Church. That's what's happening in the church. The other attention we're paying to him, though, is what he's doing outside the church. And what he's doing outside the church, with his long statement last month, The Joy of the Gospel, which was a very direct critique of economic inequality, outside the church, he has made this resounding call for a new look at the way in which the world has organized itself. And he's no economist, and he doesn't pretend to be. He's drawing our attention to the bottom line. The bottom line is there's a matter of right and wrong here, and the way human beings are treating each other is wrong.
Jeff Charlotte, does the world know what it's celebrating here? Does it know what it's in for, if Jim Carroll's right?
I really think it doesn't, and I think part of what we're... So Jim is bringing and really helping us hear that radical message that Francis is bringing that is not represented in most of the press and most of the story that we have of Francis as this guy who wears clunky shoes and used to be a bouncer and likes Twitter. This is sort of... He's a neat figure. But we're also not getting that conservative message. And that's being sort of pushed to the side, that those issues go on. So when we talk about inequality, when Francis comes and says, well, you know, he starts to speak about we need to respect women in this maternal aspect. You know, if we want to address inequality, that's the first thing we need to get rid of, this idea of that the role of women is childbearing. That's their job. To say that we can have a truce in the culture wars. Part of the reason I don't like the phrase culture wars, which is rooted in a conservative American sociologist, is it supposes that we have equal sides. So if there's a unilateral truce on his side, what's the other side? Are LGBT people supposed to say, you know what, we won't advocate for our rights? And we need to think about sexual liberation as being intrinsically related to this question of inequality, even in, especially in these countries where people are starving. I think about the question of reproductive rights throughout Africa. That's right there in inequality. And so that part of his message we're not talking about. We're not really talking about the radical message, except here on this show. And I don't hear much talk about the conservative message at all.
You're absolutely right. And which is why it's important to have in mind that he isn't a liberal.
Right.
But what I'm suggesting is that he's attending to structures of power and the abuse of power below the surface of culture, below the surface of religion, below the surface of Catholic life even. So he's opposed to the ordination of women on the one side, conservative, you're absolutely right. But on the other side, he's setting in motion an inquiry among Catholic people that is going to make their voice on this question more powerful than it's ever been before.
And most of the world is not as concerned about ordination of women as we are in the West. He is helping women in Africa already by what he's done, who aren't educated and who need education. And he's lifting up women with some of the things he said. Well, I think he said something about education of women. I could be wrong, but I think he's talked about that.
No, he says he wants the church to be a mother and a helpmeet in a very feminized way. I think one of the fascinating things about his own role is that he's casting himself in the role of the heroic nuns of the church. Not ordaining them as priests yet, but and maybe never in his life, but there is an embrace of a different role. I want to take the culture wars considerably deeper. And again, I got to credit Andrew Sullivan with this. The theology of St. Francis and Pope Francis is pro-poor forever. It's not just evening the scales. the saint gave away his wealth, and he came alive. Our world is in love with the next iPhone, and the capitalist project is to put an iPhone, two iPhones, in every pocket around the world. There is a very fundamental clash of big values. Pope Francis embraces poverty, not just out of sympathy, but because that's where his notion of Christian happiness lives, has always lived. Even human glory has always lived. There's something bigger going on there if he wants to bring on that whole challenge, is there not?
Well, that's why, you know, part of what makes him powerful is the office he occupies. The papacy is the pinnacle of a power structure. It's the Catholic Church is the last command society on the planet. Mm-hmm. He is the last leader. Not even the leaders of China have the kind of absolute authority he has as an individual. He is the Pope. And if he wanted to ordain women to the priesthood, he could do it tomorrow on his own authority. That's one of the things that's very striking about this man. What's also striking, though, is he's declining to exercise power in that way. He's yielded the power already to a process of consultation, collegiality, partnership. He established a small council of cardinals who are acting as a kind of cabinet, but they're also charged with the responsibility to feed to Rome the actual experience, the voices of the Catholic people. And he has empowered this upcoming synod to take place later this year on these very issues.
But can we not think of the taming of Barack Obama in that context?
Well, of course. And it's, again, one of the reasons why we don't want to make an idol out of Pope Francis. He's no more the Messiah than Barack Obama was. And one of the mistakes American liberals made was falling into the old impulse to declare a Messiah figure.
What's the corrective?
The corrective is to understand that we're all human beings, we're all in this together, and we're all subject to the same limits on our experience, our knowledge, our wisdom. None of us has the truth. We get the truth together by encountering each other and searching it out together, by criticizing each other and submitting to criticism. That's what this Pope is actually doing.
Amen. And he's saying it very clearly. The truth is a relationship.
It's exactly true, which is not the way Catholic theologians and prelates have often talked.
But are people hearing it? They're going further. So, for instance, there's also this another sort of bit of folklore moving around that there's already been a third Vatican Council. You saw this, a satirical site wrote an article declaring that there was a third Vatican Council and that the Pope had declared all religions equal and all equally true. And this took off. It went viral. And people believed it. Protestants believe it. Catholics believe it. This goes back to what Peter Manceau and Chris are saying about people will do with the church what they want to do. In the same way that they insist, no matter what, that the Pope is sneaking out at night. This is the thing that's so fascinating to me, this story that the Pope puts on a costume and sneaks out at night to go amongst the poor. So can the Pope escape this commodification? I like the idea of what you're talking about, this Gorbachev analogy, the man who's talking himself out of a job, but is it the job too big for him?
Jeff Charlotte, we've just barely begun, and we're out of time. Thank you, Jim Carroll, Liz Walker, Jeff Charlotte, Mary Gordon, Peter Manceau. Listeners, you can hear this whole program and extended versions of Peter Manceau and Mary Gordon on our website, radioopensource.org. We'd like to say the conversation isn't over until listeners have weighed in with their own two bits in our comment stream. Thanks to our Vox Pop callers who contributed their own quick phone lines on Pope Francis. There will be a new question to react to next week. We'll be wondering why we neglect our health in all the furor about health care. We had help at WBUR this week from Margaret Evans and Paul Vakas, and the talented George Hicks at the controls tonight. We had patient backing from the Wild Idea Buffalo Company. Check it out at wildideabuffalo.com. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. Sam Madden was our executive millennial this week. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.